Good evening. I'm Jim Zirin. Welcome back to Conversations in the Digital Age. We have a great treat in store for you this evening. With us is Stephen Sestanovich. Stephen Sestanovich is a Russian expert. He served in the Reagan administration as a member of the National Security Council staff. He served in the Clinton administration. He was ambassador at large in Russia. In addition, he has written a terrific new book entitled Maximalist, America and the World from Truman to Obama. And Steve, we're delighted to have you with us.
Thanks, Jim.
And we look forward very much to chatting with you. Congratulations on your book. It really was a terrific read. I was fascinated by it, particularly in light of current events in the Ukraine. And you cover a period of about six decades and 11 presidents. And you talk about maximalism and retrenchment. Is there a common thread that you see in all this?
Well, the common thread is American foreign policy makers generally operate in one of two modes. That is, they are pedal to the metal, problem solving, throw resources at a problem, determined to enlarge the American role in the world, or they're retrenchers. In which case they are reducing American commitment, cutting resources, shifting burdens to allies, trying to find a way to focus generally on domestic affairs because of a conviction that the United States has tried to do too much.
Reducing defense budgets, trying to do it on the cheap.
Doing it on the cheap is a characteristic of American foreign policy.
Now, as you go through the 60... odd years that you write about, and really it's the period of my lifetime, so it's like staying tuned with what's going on in Washington and the world as you go through the book, which is just terrific. The common challenge in American foreign policy seems to be Russia, for each president.
That's a big one in the Cold War, of course. It's also a preoccupation in the post-Cold War period because American presidents want to figure out how to get the relationship with Russia right. That's been true of the first President Bush, Bill Clinton, the second President Bush, and now Barack Obama has had his own set of challenges with Russia.
And trying to get it right, what has been the differing approach between maximalist presidents and I guess like Kennedy, and we had the Cuban Missile Crisis with Russia, called them the Soviets then, but it's the same country, and the retrenchers.
Well, maximalists tend to focus on gaining advantage, on tipping the balance of power in their favor against the Russians, trying to establish a broad alliance, a set of principles that the Russians can't compete with. Retrenchment presidents have focused more on reaching understandings, on trying to forge partnerships, and that's been particularly true since the Cold War ended. The expectation that Russia could be a partner has been a powerful one for most presidents in the past 25 years.
Now, in the 2012 campaign, Governor Romney said that Russia was our greatest geopolitical threat, and which was poo-pooed by the Democrats and poo-pooed by many others who had dismissed Russia as perhaps a Burundi with missiles. But in light of the recent events in Ukraine and Crimea, does it revive the notion that they are our greatest geopolitical threat?
Well, the Russians are certainly misbehaving, and that has made people dig up Governor Romney's quote and say, see, this is exactly what he meant. I'm not sure what he meant at the time, to be honest, and President Obama in the debates pretty much brushed that aside and said, oh, that's just silly, and most people believed it. You remember in the 2012 campaign, foreign policy played virtually no role because Governor Romney could not find a way to convince people that the Obama administration had mishandled its international relations. So it was easy for the president to just swat that one aside. Today, it's much more complicated. And in a whole series of areas, questions are being raised about the president's policies, not just concerning Russia.
Well, with regard to the Crimea incursion, the UN, the NATO Secretary General Rasmussen says it's the gravest threat to European security for a generation. And Richard Haass called the Crimean move the most serious and potentially the most dangerous international crisis of the post-Cold War or post-post-Cold War period. I mean, do you agree with those assessments?
Well, I think what's happened is very serious. There's no doubt about it. When you've got a big country tearing up a little one and absorbing the territory, I mean, it's traditional conquest.
It's an Anschluss.
It's bad news. It's destabilizing, and it makes everybody else wonder what's going on. It is not a small part of this that the big country that is tearing up the other country happens to be our old foe from the Cold War, and that evokes all kinds of bad memories as well. So the threat tends to look larger because of that, but it's a pretty serious threat anyway.
Well, particularly coupled with the fact that its leader, Mr. Putin, says that the breakup of the old Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. So do you feel he's trying to end the period of geopolitical retreat for Russia and start advancing? First the Ukraine, tomorrow the Baltics or Moldavia or whatever.
Well, I think there's no doubt that Putin has wanted to restore Russian influence over neighboring states of the former Soviet Union. Ukraine, Moldova, you name it. I think this particular case of aggression was kind of a broken play. He had been looking to restore Russian influence over all of Ukraine, and the whole thing blew up in his face. He was looking at one of the most serious defeats of his tenure as president. And his response was a kind of reckless one to say, okay, we're going to grab a little bit of Ukrainian territory. If we can't dominate the whole of Ukraine, we can at least seize a part of it.
It's like the Mel Brooks line, a little bit of Poland, a little bit of France.
Well, Putin is, I think, not a great chess player. I think he has antagonized so many people with this, even though he's gotten some significant domestic payoff from what he's done. Crimea is territory that he had de facto control over. And it's incredible that he's decided to create this great international crisis merely to establish de jure sovereignty where he had de facto control.
Well, it was originally part of Russia, and then Khrushchev, I guess, gave it to Ukraine. But, of course, he controlled Ukraine completely at the time. So it was almost like a corporate reorganization.
Well, Putin has said this was something very bad, and he said of the Bolsheviks who moved around borders, he said, may God judge them. So he's invoked the Almighty against Khrushchev.
Yes, in his speech he spoke of, used various religious icons and religious images to justify what he'd done. So do you think it's part of a grand strategy? You say he's not a chess player. Is he thinking of the next move, or is it just all tactical where he moves here and moves there?
As I say, I think his desire is to increase Russian influence, and he has particularly nationalist vocabulary for that. He has, in his speech explaining the annexation of Crimea, he trotted out a kind of litany of grievances about the way in which Russia had suffered as a consequence of the breakup of the Soviet Union. So he's using this we're back on our feet imagery to create a stronger domestic legitimacy and to warn other countries that he now stands for something different and seeks a larger role for Russia.
Can he get away with it in light of his faltering economy? And he has so many domestic problems.
He has promised an increase in the defense budget that he's probably going to have to scale back. On the other hand, with this kind of success under his belt, he is going to have both greater support for a more robust defense policy and diplomacy in general, He's also going to have to live up to some of the expectations that he's created. He's now said, we are looking out for Russians everywhere. You know, almost 10 years ago, the Russian folks in a small enclave in Moldova asked to join Russia. The Russians said no. They've now revived the request. It's unclear.
In speech, he talked of Ruskies.
The Russians are now in a kind of nationalist frame of mind, and that may create opportunities or even requirements for a policy that picks on its neighbors.
Almost a pan-Slavism. But now you go back to the U.S. stance. How do we confront this crisis? And in your book, you start really in terms of U.S. policy in 1947 with Kennan's containment in his famous foreign affairs article. Now, he didn't mean military containment of the Soviets at that time, did he?
Kennan had in mind the need to stabilize the world that would otherwise be susceptible to Soviet pressure. And his principal focus was helping the Western European economies get back on their feet. He didn't envision a permanent large role for the United States, and in fact had in mind many more compromises with the Soviet Union than were accepted by other policymakers. But that was a moment where the United States was feeling its way toward a more maximalist conception of its role in the world. And it was a steadily enlarging set of responsibilities that the United States took upon itself.
Now, subsequent presidents, presidents subsequent to 1947, continued the policy of containment in one form or another. It was often misinterpreted, isn't that so?
Well, we tend to think of American policy throughout the Cold War as kind of continuous because it had this one-word name throughout this period. But the argument I make in the book is that that's actually a mistake. That, in fact, if we look more closely at what presidents did, there is this cycle of the assertion of American power, the enlargement of American aims, more activist, maximalist mode, followed, when the maximalists overdo it, by a period of retrenchment. So I think if you see American policy as just continuous, you're missing that cyclical alternation, the overdoing it and underdoing it.
Now, Putin, in his speech, viewed it as monolithic. He talked about the infamous policy of containment. He said, and I quote, "They are constantly trying to sweep us into a corner. They are the Americans because we have an independent position, because we maintain it, and because we call things like they are and do not engage in hypocrisy." I mean, is there anything to what he had to say?
Well, Putin is mad, and he is
even hateful.
Is trotting out the complaints that many Russians have made over the past 25 years, in particular, a period in which they believe the United States has not taken their interests sufficiently seriously, and there's a whole list of complaints that you could make. The biggest complaint, though, is really that Russia has been weak. And his solution to this is not to persuade the United States to be more reasonable. It's for Russia to become strong. That's what he wants to do. And he's saying when we're strong, they then won't be able to treat us this way.
Now, let's talk weak. Russians regard Obama as weak. And they feel they got away with something in Crimea. It only makes them bolder to take the next step.
You know, this is a problem for retrenchment presidents.
Obama's a retrenchment president.
Obama is a retrenchment president. Retrenchment presidents are the ones who come in to clean up some mess, some bit of overextension. Eisenhower was a retrenchment president after the Korean War.
I will go to Korea.
Exactly. You know, Truman had made a mess there. Eisenhower was supposed to fix it. Nixon was the retrenchment president who came in after Vietnam. President Obama was brought in by the American people at the end of the Bush administration with the assignment of really downsizing American foreign policy. 79% of both Republicans and Democrats, when the president came in, said the United States needs a smaller role in the world. The problem that retrenchment presidents have is that their retrenchment tends to be seen as a sign of reduced commitment, less conviction, less firmness in the world, and that makes allies nervous and it makes adversaries encouraged. There are many Russians who will tell you that Putin regards Obama as weak and indecisive, and they point to examples where Putin has acted on the assumption that he can get away with something.
But what about the example of Syria? Isn't that a paradigm example of where Obama's weak, that he established a red line and Assad crossed the red line and we wound up doing nothing?
A lot of people around the world thought that was a very damaging episode for American policy because the president said he was going to do something and then he didn't. My own view of that is slightly different in this respect, that the reason Putin was prepared to bail the president out was that he thought that ultimately Obama would be obliged to use force, and Putin did not want that. So he was trying to find a way to prevent the use of American force because that's one of his key goals, is to show that the United States cannot act independently.
But it also enhanced Putin's status that he pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire and wound up being the hero.
It did. People around the world were treating Putin as though he were some great geopolitical mastermind, and Crimea has only enhanced his reputation.
And coming on the heels of Sochi, was it a bad timing from a public relations standpoint for Putin to annex Crimea right after this great public relations coup at, with the Olympics?
I think it would have been bad timing for Putin no matter what. When you've got people around the world photoshopping your picture to add a Hitler mustache to it, you know you've got a PR problem that needs to be solved.
Now, you wrote a New York Times op-ed in which you said we're paying a price for pulling back in the world. And I guess that refers to Obama retrenchment. What is the price we're paying? Does it embolden people like Putin to take these lawless actions?
Well, I wasn't focusing on Putin in that case, although it certainly would be would fit within the perspective. I made the case that the president, if he wants his own diplomacy to succeed, needs to be able to galvanize American alliances, assert American power more credibly. And I give you two examples. The president has sometimes let it be thought that he wants a deal with Iran so as to involve the United States less in the Middle East. I think the president is likely to find that a deal with Iran is going to be viable only if he can shore up American relations with its allies in the Middle East. I think the same thing is true in East Asia, where the president has talked about a pivot, but the real test of this rebalancing toward East Asia is going to be the effectiveness of American power in deterring China, in resolving conflicts, on the basis of credible American warnings and commitments. So a retrenchment president, in order to make his own diplomacy work, has got to be taken seriously.
So Obama's response to the Crimean crisis has been some economic sanctions against Russia don't appear to be that heavy, and some diplomatic isolation. But really, a little more than that. Do you think that's going to be sufficient to deter Putin?
Well, I think the measures that the president has taken will not be enough to get Putin to throw up his hands and give Crimea back to Ukraine. That's probably out.
So does Obama have to convert to maximalism in order to stop Putin?
Well, that's an open question, and it's an interesting period for any retrenchment president when challenges begin to mount and people begin to say, this is actually this kind of retrenchment is producing bad results for us. The president has responded to that challenge. He's understood that in Crimea he had the as at risk of having the core of America's power position in the world unravel. That is, its relations with NATO allies. So he made a big point in his trip to Europe of trying to revive the alliance, restore American credibility in Europe, talked about enlarged military presence in Eastern European allies of the United States. He recommitted himself to a trade pact with Europe that he had sort of put on the back burner. He emphasized the centrality of this issue and tried to make himself look like a genuine international leader where people had begun to wonder. Whether that will turn into a more activist foreign policy in general, I think remains to be seen. But there's no doubt that Obama has treated this as a serious warning about where retrenchment leads you.
Should he have done more to shore up Ukraine, more aid to Ukraine, perhaps having them invited to EU membership, helping their economy so that there's less chance that they will disintegrate on their own and Putin will march in saying, I had to do it to save Ukraine?
Helping Ukraine is, I can tell you from personal experience, not the easiest thing to do.
So much of it goes into the pockets of the politicians. It's
a country with corrupt politics, sort of dysfunctional institutions in many ways, and a divided society. So helping Ukraine restabilize itself, revive its economy, reform its politics is going to be a pretty ambitious undertaking. I think it's a requirement. If we want to limit the disruptive potential, the destabilizing impact of Putin's new policy, the core of it has to be helping Ukraine to succeed.
What about a military show of strength? Les Gelb has advocated that we send F-12s to Poland and perhaps even missiles as just a show of strength. Of course, the fine line between a show of strength and provocation, and this could get us involved in a very serious military situation. What's your view of that?
I think there's going to be an increased chorus of requests from allies who are close to Russia to show in one way or another that we have some military muscle behind our political commitment to them. Whether that involves a build-up here or a build-up there, I think is going to play out over some period. But I would say that pivot to a more militarized policy of support for allies in Europe, that one we've already kind of accepted in principle. We're now working out the details.
Obama's becoming a maximalist.
Well, he is doing what presidents who have launched retrenchment and then seen what some of the problems with it are generally do. But this policy of retrenchment is usually a long one. I point out that the trough in defense spending, for example, and of indecisive foreign policies and pullbacks, those periods tend to be longer than the maximalist period that precedes them. So I think we don't know yet what crisis will trigger a real end to American retrenchment, if there is in fact an end to it. The world is kind of different now, and the American public seems to feel less enthusiasm for a large international role. We don't know where this is headed. When retrenchment ends, it ends in crisis. But whether this one will end, we don't know.
You think it's possible to stop Putin short of war?
I think Putin is probably being told by some of his people and wondering himself whether he may have overreached a little bit. My sense is that for him to be breaking up Ukraine now would create such a coalition against him and such hostility that he would not think it was worth the price. So I think he will pursue a slightly more cautious policy for a while. But I think we've seen that he's unleashed quite powerful currents, both domestically and abroad. And so we're in for a rougher time in this part of the world.
So I have a question for you, Steve Stasanovich. The question is, How do we stop Putin from making a move on Ukraine?
Well, I think we have to make Ukraine succeed. That's a tough assignment, but it's the core of a successful policy.
Make Ukraine succeed.
Make them succeed. Help them succeed.
This has been just marvelous. Thank you so much for coming by. It's too bad we've run out of time because this was a wonderful conversation. And thank you for coming by. Tune in next week for more conversations in the digital age. I'm Jim Zirin. Please visit our website at www.digitalage.org. Good night and all the best.